Avrakatos came to see things differently once he discovered that there was a venerable blood feud running between the Pashtuns and Masud's Tajik tribe. The campaign against Masud became even more suspect once he realized that many of the Pakistani ISI officers were themselves Pashtuns, and that they maintained a formal relationship with these Afghan resistance leaders that had begun years before the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Avrakatos figured that whatever the cause for Masud's sit-down strike, the ISI wasn't helping matters by withholding the CIA's weapons. As far as he was concerned, it would be a disaster to write Masud off. Somehow, a way had to be found to get the commander back in action, and Gust knew it was useless to look to the ISI. The agency, under MacGaffin's direction, had already begun using the British for information about Masud. Unlike the CIA and the U.S. government, which operated with a strict taboo against any Americans crossing into Afghanistan, British SAS commandos had been going in and out of the Panjshir since the beginning of the war. They even had a way of moving supplies to Masud independent of the Pakistanis. In London, Avrakatos asked for a personal meeting with MI6's Masud expert. He turned out to be a young, blonde SAS guerrilla warfare expert with the peculiar nickname of Auk, a name said to vaguely resemble the grunting noise he would make on maneuvers. Auk had just returned from 3 months inside the war zone. It was about a 2-week journey in those days, walking north from the Pakistan border through Nuristan and the Hindu Kush to reach Masud's valley. Auk had gone in with two other SAS commandos. Their report had astonished Avrakatos.
"There was one passage in there that really got me," remembers Avrakatos. "This guy was sleeping with a couple of his buddies, and he said he woke one night and heard horrible groans. He didn't get up, but was able to put on his night vision goggles and saw a group of Masud's guys literally cornholing a Russian prisoner."
The Afghan presiding over the rape was one of Masud's lieutenants. Auk described in his report how uncomfortable he and his two friends had felt, particularly because they were good-looking blonde boys and Masud's man seemed to have developed a crush on one of them. For the last 2 weeks of their stay in the Panjshir, he said, they went to sleep with their weapons by their sides, always ready to fight it out if their Afghan friends approached in the dark. Then one day the three Englishmen and their Afghan escorts were lured into a Soviet ambush. The British were dressed as Mujahideen, and Auk said that they absolutely would have been killed but for the lieutenant who had so terrorized their knights. Suddenly he bolted from them, running into the open field to draw the helicopter's Gatling guns away from the men he sought to protect. At MI6 headquarters, Auk told Avrakatos that watching that man die had made him finally understand the Afghans' ancient code, honor, hospitality, and revenge. Raping an infidel invader was not the atrocity it would be in the West, it was simply revenge. Above all, Auk had come away convinced that these were men of honor. When it came to picking an ally to fight the Soviets, he told Avrakatos, there was no shortage of Tajik courage. They were every bit as good as the Pashtuns. Now the only question for Avrakatos was how to get Masud back in the field. Auk and his MI6 superiors took the position that Masud would return to the fight as soon as he was adequately supplied. They made it clear that they were able to secretly funnel weapons to Masud without the ISI's knowledge. It was almost embarrassing, however, for the British division chief to have to explain how little they were able to provide. It's often a small detail that says it all, and when the MI6 division chief told Avrakatos why they were having difficulty finding Afghans willing to drive supplies up to Masud, Avrakatos realized they were hopelessly broke. "They keep getting maimed," the officer explained, "because the route is mined and we don't have any mine detectors to give them."
"How many could you use?" Avrakatos asked. "Would 10 be too much?" the MI6 man inquired nervously.
Gust insisted that they accept 25, and even a decade later he remembers this exchange with amazement.
"Do you know what mine detectors go for? $300. Can you believe it? They were losing drivers and loaders because they couldn't afford 25 mine detectors."
Technically, Avrakatos was in London to consult with a co-equal intelligence service, but during this visit he realized he had something that these able and ambitious British spies desperately needed. With his American money, he could put them back in the game. They had something equally valuable to offer Avrakatos in return, no lawyers to contend with, and, as Gust enviously put it, a prime minister to the right of Attila the Hun. Almost immediately on that first visit to MI6, Avrakatos began sketching in his mind a grand design for putting the British to work. Later he would reflect that they had given him options that were simply denied to the CIA. They had a willingness to do jobs I couldn't touch. They basically took care of the how-to-kill-people department. Gust knew he would be skating perilously close to the edge. But with MI6 he was in the presence of old pros, and he figured that as long as he never specifically discussed what they would be doing with the money he planned to provide them, he would, technically, not be breaking any U.S. laws. So, at the end of their talks, Gust committed to a major increase in the CIA's subsidy to the Brits with just one condition. They must not tell him or any other agency official about any lethal operations. "If I'm ever brought up before a committee," he explained, "I'll have to say what I know. Please don't tell me for your own good and mine." Later, when Charlie's money began to roll in, Avrakatos says, "The Brits were eventually able to buy things that we couldn't because it infringed on murder, assassination, and indiscriminate bombings. They could issue guns with silencers. We couldn't do that because a silencer immediately implied assassination, and heaven forbid car bombs. No way I could even suggest it. But I could say to the Brits, Fadallah in Beirut was really effective last week. They had a car bomb that killed 300 people. I gave MI6 stuff in good faith. What they did with it was always their business." But Avrakatos wasn't about to pay the British to completely take over such an invaluable asset as Ahmad Shah Massoud. Immediately, after expanding the MI6 account, he set about to create an independent U.S. channel to Massoud as well. Not that he didn't appreciate MI6's efforts, it's just that interests inevitably diverge, and he wanted America to have its own piece of Massoud's war. During this time, Gust showed up in Peshawar in disguise, a fake limp, different hair color, elaborate security, to meet Massoud's brother. Avrakatos was now beginning to assert his independence, even from the ISI, which until then had enjoyed total control over the agency's Afghan efforts. In their secret meeting in Peshawar behind Dean's Hotel, Avrakatos made one of those offers to the lion's brother that cannot be refused. By late 1984, agency money would immediately begin to flow into Massoud's Swiss bank account, and with Art Alper's input, all kinds of exotic hardware for killing Russians started to move on the backs of camels and mules toward the Panjshir. It would prove to be important aid during this moment of intense Soviet escalation in 1984 and 1985. All Gust asked for in return that day was that Massoud keep killing Soviets and remember who his friends were. Avrakatos is quite matter-of-fact about the reason for sidestepping his British pals. "You can't allow even a friend to have a monopoly on the most effective fighter. The ante to get into the game was money, and by giving it directly, we had a voice at the table." One of the main reasons for fixing an independent American channel was to make sure the agency was in the game if, for example, Massoud captured a KGB communications van. The last thing he wanted was for the Brits to walk away with such a prize. It didn't take Avrakatos long, once he started funding such programs, to discover that there wasn't nearly enough money to do the things he knew would be effective. He began stretching the rules to the breaking point. Years before, an agency finance officer had taught him a trick for surviving when an operational budget runs dry. By law, any money not spent by the end of a fiscal year is automatically returned to the U.S. Treasury and lost to the agency. It's one of the ways Congress keeps Central Intelligence accountable, by preventing the buildup of a discretionary war chest. A neat way to undercut this safeguard is to get other division chiefs to divert their extra monies to your project. We all know the routine. What you do is get someone in, say, the Tokyo station to pick up the tab. This is where a good finance officer is invaluable, explains the master at walking the bureaucratic tightrope. On the QT, they can find out who has surpluses. No one likes to have surpluses. It looks like you can't spend it, right? So I go to a guy with a surplus and say, "Will you help? When I'm fat one day, I'll help you." John, my predecessor, lived off the fat of others with promises, and when I got in and got some money, I paid them all back. Avrakatos acknowledges that what he had in mind went far beyond anything the division chief Chuck Cogan would have tolerated. But then Cogan hadn't grown up in Aliquippa.